Headlines this hour. The Iraqi government dismisses Pentagon's claims about cooperation between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. deadly airstrikes in Syria. The U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions calls on the U.S. to impose sanctions on the Saudi Crown Prince over his role in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And police in Myanmar's main city of Yangon use force to disperse people holding a fresh rally against the ruling junta, reportedly killing one protester. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Baghdad has denied any cooperation with Washington over Thursday's deadly U.S. airstrikes on eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. In a statement, the Iraqi Interior Ministry said no intelligence was exchanged with the U.S.-led coalition forces in Iraq for the raids. The ministry noted that its cooperation with the coalition is limited to boosting Iraq's internal security. The Iraqi Defense Ministry also expressed surprise at Pentagon's claims of intelligence sharing before the attacks on the Syrian territory. The ministry said its cooperation with the U.S.-led forces is restricted to the specific goal of forming the coalition, which is to fight the Daesh terror group. Pentagon has said that Baghdad helped Washington conduct the raids through its information gathering. U.S. President Joe Biden says the recent American airstrikes on Syria was a warning to Iran that it cannot act with impunity. Biden told reporters during a visit to storm-hit U.S. state of Texas that Tehran should be careful. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, made a similar remark. He said the U.S. administration wanted to make it very clear, notably to Iran, that acting against American people, partners, and interests cannot go with impunity. The U.S. conducted airstrikes on Syria's eastern province of Deir al-Zor near the Iraqi border on Thursday. The attack was the first of its kind under the Biden administration and targeted facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemns the U.S. airstrikes in eastern Syria as a violation of human rights, international law, and Syria's territorial integrity. The ministry's spokesman said the U.S. strikes are in line with Israel's aggression against Syria and would increase instability and military encounters. Said Khatibzadeh said the U.S.'s years-long presence in Syria is illegal and accused the U.S. of occupying the Syrian soil and stealing its natural resources, including oil. Khatibzadeh said the illegal U.S. bases in Syria are used for training terrorists. On Thursday, the U.S. launched overnight airstrikes on facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The attack was ordered by U.S. President Joe Biden. Syria also strongly condemned the move.
The Syrian Arab Republic condemns in the strongest terms the U.S. aggression against its sovereignty, which contradicts the terms of international law and the United Nations Charter, and with its role as a permanent member of the Security Council.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned that the U.S. aggression would lead to repercussions that escalate the situation in the region. The Iraqi resistance movements also condemned the attacks. Iraq's Kataib Hezbollah group slammed the strikes as barbaric aggression. Secretary General of the Ba'ath organization Hadi al-Ahmadi called on the Iraqi government to investigate the U.S. strikes. In a statement, the al-Nujaba Islamic Resistance Movement stressed that the U.S. attacks would not go unanswered. International lawyer Barry Grossman says Washington, with its airstrikes on Syria, targeted those who are truly fighting the U.S.-backed terrorism.
Let's be clear about this. The U.S. claims ostensibly that this bombing run was an act of retaliation carried out in defense of U.S. troops. The U.S. chose at this point in time to bomb those sites and to target elements working with the Iraqi government. These militia forces are there fighting what we've come to call terrorist elements, which were trained, armed, and supported by the U.S. Very effectively, whereas the United States military has been in very clear terms asked by the Iraqi government to leave and nevertheless remains in Iraq. So it's a bit rich for the Americans to be saying that this was some kind of a defensive strike.
The U.S. has released a report confirming that Saudi Arabia's crown prince and the de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Washington has failed to take concrete action to bring the main culprit to justice.
The U.S. has finally released a long-awaited report on the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi,
confirming that the Crown Prince had personally approved an operation to capture or kill him. Accordingly, the U.S. says it has imposed sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder. However, Washington's restrictions only target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, not their patron and commander, Mohammed bin Salman. That once again exposes Washington's double standard in dealing with criminals, despite its own intelligence assessment that Khashoggi was killed and his body dismembered at the behest of bin Salman in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN has reacted to the CIA report, saying the U.S. fails to take practical steps to hold the main culprit accountable.
With the release of the U.S. report confirming Saudi officials' culpability at the highest levels, the United States should now take the lead in ensuring accountability for this crime and for setting in place the international mechanisms to prevent and punish such acts in the future. The United States government should impose sanctions against the Crown Prince as it has done for the other perpetrators, targeting his personal assets but also his international engagements.
Reactions are also pouring in from other authorities and legal experts who have dismissed the U.S. report as too little, too late.
This is not enough. The Crown Prince needs to face accountability. He needs to face sanctions, asset freezes, travel bans.
Analysts are also criticizing the White House for failing to take the Saudi Crown Prince to account.
Nobody saw the actual report until now. And yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible. And that rogue is bin Salman himself.
Many believe Washington's failure to hold bin Salman accountable is due to its interests. Even the U.S. itself has admitted that it is seeking its own interests in maintaining a close partnership with Riyadh.
I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
In fact, decades-old U.S.-Saudi nexus have benefited the both, with Riyadh spending its petrodollars for American arms and Washington hatching plots to destabilize the region for its own sake. The U.S. backing for the Saudi regime's deadly mayhem in Yemen over the past 5 years is part of such plots. If the new U.S. administration claims that it really wants to break with the policies of the Trump government, it should walk the walk rather than talk the talk and stop supporting the al-Saud regime that has a long history of malign disregard for not only its own citizens like Khashoggi, but even the impoverished people like Yemenis.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The United Nations and the European members of the Security Council urged the Israeli regime to stop demolitions in a Palestinian village in the occupied Jordan Valley. The European Council members expressed deep concern at the recent repeated demolitions and the confiscation of items in Humsa al-Baqaya. They said the concern was also focused on the 70 people or so living in the Bedouin community, including 41 children. The EU countries also called on the regime to allow humanitarian access to the community. This was also echoed by the UN envoy for the region. Tor Wennesland urged Israel to cease the demolition and seizure of Palestinian property throughout the occupied West Bank. Occupied Ramallah Mona Kandil joins us, and we also have Jamal Juma, who's head of the Stop the Wall campaign, joining us also from occupied Ramallah. Mona, tell us more about this report in terms of what Israel is doing.
It's not the first time Israeli military destroy and demolish homes and infrastructure in the village of Humsa al-Baqiya. It's in the Jordan Valley. It's an area, see, that the Israelis completely control, do not allow the Palestinians to build there. So what the Israelis are doing there, it's an attempt to force the people of Humsa out of the area in order to confiscate their lands and annex them to the nearby Israeli settlements. Palestinians there are not allowed to build and construct their homes. It's very difficult. From 2006, only 2% of Palestinians were given permission to build in that area, even though these lands are owned by Palestinians. So the report comes in order to demand the Israeli regime to stop destroying these buildings and these homes and tents. We are not speaking about buildings. They are simple homes and tents for the people and their sheep and cattle living there.
General Juma, when you take a look at how Biden, even though it's pretty still relatively early in the way that he's handled Israel, which has been close to nothing, but do you foresee any type of change to happen under this administration when it comes to Palestinians and their rights?
And first of all, when we talk about Hamsa, for us as a Palestinians, we understand it as part of the wide ethnic cleansing in the Jordan Valley, particularly the northern part of the Jordan Valley. This starts with Hamsa. So the international community didn't see this as a crime against humanity, a crime against the people. This is the problem. But also we have a record with the United Nations, with the international organizations. They are condemning what Israel is doing. They're asking Israel, they're begging Israel just to stop their demolishing. And this is not the way to deal with that. Israel is in a state, a criminal state, that have an act of violent, of the destruction of the people's property, violating international law. So what we have to deal with it is just to put an kind of sanctions on Israel. It has to stop so many trade agreements with Israel, like the EU, the EU-Israel free trade agreement. There is so many means of pressure that they can put in Israel, but there is no political willing to do that. It's clearly Israel is backed up by the West, particularly by the United States, by the European Union. All what they do is trying to push Israel to do. And Israel is not willing to do. Israel has a strategic plan in the West Bank. They and all Palestine, they want Israel from the sea to the river. They want to evacuate the people. They want to block the Palestinians in isolations and ghettos in order to control their future. That's what Israel is designing in Palestine. And this is what we demand the people to look at and to recognize. And from that point, they can deal with Israel acts on the ground.
If I may have your thoughts on the recent development regarding the U.S. and the UNHRC, that it says that it wants to rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, and one of the main purposes of that, aside from upholding human rights, is to shield Israel. Isn't that in a sense saying shielding Israel from violations that it executes in the occupied territories?
Execute the Palestinian rights, execute the Palestinian future on their land. This is what we are facing as a people now, is a challenge to our future. To our future and our land, our rights. What they recognize two-state solution, where is the two-state solution? There's nothing, nothing now applicable on the ground according to what Israel is doing. So when we talk about these issues, they have to take this into consideration. When they do that, they just like sacrifice all the Palestinian rights.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Jamal Juma, head of Stop the Wall campaign in Ramallah. Also like to thank Mona Kandil, a correspondent, who gave us an update also from occupied Ramallah. And that brings us to the end of this news review. Welcome back. Chaotic scenes in Myanmar, where police have used force against a crowd protesting the military rule. Officers in riot gear fired rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse protesters in the main city of Yangon and elsewhere. The protesters chanted slogans against the military, calling its chief a crazy dictator. Local media say that a woman was shot dead during a rally in the town of Manwaya. A number of people, including media workers, were also arrested. Myanmar has been shaken by a wave of protests since a military coup toppled the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. Suu Kyi and much of her party leadership are in custody over allegations of fraud in a November election that they won. South Korea has started vaccinating healthcare workers against the coronavirus one day after launching its national vaccination campaign. About 55,000 medical workers will receive Pfizer vaccine doses, while some 290,000 will be given AstraZeneca jabs. South Korea kicked off its vaccination drive by giving shots to nursing home workers and some patients at COVID facilities. Authorities say over 1,800 people have already received the first doses of AstraZeneca on the first day of the campaign. The government plans to vaccinate at least 70% of the country's population by November to reach herd immunity. South Korea has so far recorded more than 89,000 infections and nearly 1,600 COVID deaths. Local authorities in Brazil are resorting to new lockdowns and curfews to control the surge in the COVID-19 outbreak in the country. The country's capital city, Brasilia, was put under a 24-hour lockdown on Friday, leaving open only essential services. A dozen other state capitals have also imposed lockdowns, with some declaring nighttime curfews. This comes as the country's coronavirus death toll topped 251,000 after over 1,580 deaths were recorded. That's the second highest daily toll in Brazil, and unseen since the peak of the pandemic in July. Despite the surge, President Jair Bolsonaro once again criticized the lockdowns, threatening governors to cut off federal emergency assistance if they don't lift the restrictions. EU leaders expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants within the 27-nation bloc, amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. The handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes has more.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevot feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant, I was managing a restaurant, and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do next, what we can do, what the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B.1.1.7 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
More anti-government protests in Chile turn violent, with police and riot gear clashing with demonstrators in the capital, Santiago. The police used water cannon and fired tear gas to disperse the crowds that were seen throwing rocks at law enforcers and attacking their armored vehicles. The Latin American country has witnessed street protests since late 2019 over social inequality. Demonstrations then started with fare hikes, setting off an intense wave of unrest that led to over two dozen deaths. Lately, the police killing of a street artist has intensified the protest. National and international human rights groups accuse security forces of using excessive force against the people expressing their anger at government policies. And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Detroit was once the city of the American dream and the success of the automotive industry. It was regarded as the engine of America's automotive industry. With over 2 million inhabitants in the 50s, Detroit was one of the richest cities in the world. Thanks to its triumph came the middle class. But the American dream did not last for long, and slowly things started to fall apart. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. With the collapse of Detroit's industrial hegemony, unemployment and deterioration spiraled out of control. On the verge of bankruptcy, this once thriving metropolitan is now a ghost town. The population has halved to about 700,000 people, and everywhere in the city there are large areas affected by the abandonment. Hundreds and thousands of homes, schools, churches, and shops are in ruins, giving the city an eerie feeling. Stay with us as this week's program follows several individuals left in Detroit trying to make sense out of the chaos.
Detroit was industry. And at the beginning of the 20th century, industry was king. So car obviously changed everything. I mean, the assembly line was invented here. It changed the way that manufacturing was done. Then you had streetlights. You had paved roads. You know, all of these things started here. And they spread out. So in a lot of ways, Detroit changed the world. And with all of these factories, with all of these jobs, these people that were making a living wage, you know, the middle class was invented in Detroit. So with all of this fortune came grandeur, beautiful buildings, beautiful movie theaters and office buildings. You know, Detroit really kind of, it was a cosmopolitan place. As the American automobile was really the only game in town, things were great. And then as foreign makes started happening, as outsourcing of jobs started bleeding the city of its population, things started to go downhill.
Out of the American dream, which has run its course and has now seen defeat. Unfortunately, we climbed a credit mountain, and now we sit inside the shell of the debt that it created. We have a lot of empty houses, a lot of empty streets, just entire sections of the city that are sparsely, very sparsely populated. It's kind of buckling at the knees and toppling, and it's a mess.
Is desperately wrong, and y'all go pay for it. Yes. And I hope some of y'all be marched and in mind going to jail. Right. Because that's where you need to be at. You talk about us, you sit there and you laugh at us, you go out here and you go to Mackinac and you talk about what else you're going to give away. We don't have too much more. But I'm going to fight for what I believe in, and that's the city of Detroit. Y'all can go to, I'm not going to stay, but y'all can go there.
These people don't understand what it means to be a representative of the people and be in the city council. And I keep hearing things like, well, I'm going to vote according to what I think is best for the people. I keep hearing that word, I think is best for the people. Have you talked to the people? The people are sitting in the room. They're selling no.
I had lost a house already. I couldn't refinance it, and so there, it had to get foreclosed on. That was back in 2006 when I got booted out of the corporate job that I had, and I looked at the corporate world, and I said, this is really messed up. I mean, I know that my life is out to make a difference, and I looked for where was that difference going to hit. And I knew that this movement was going to be something that has a foothold. It has the opportunity to make a difference. When you become an activist, there's something about it. There's something about having hope for and fighting for a future. It breeds life. You ask the question, why? Like a 3-year-old asks. And so every day is a discovery process. I am going to do something. Now, what I'm going to do has to be defined. But I do know that the objective is to make the city available to the people.
About Jennifer's story, I said, Jennifer's a woman. She's struggling with foreclosure. So many people said to me, yeah, we're all struggling with foreclosure. Even if you're personally not facing foreclosure, maybe your neighbor is. Maybe you got an empty house on your block that's a blight, you know what I mean, that lowers your property value, that's dangerous. And if this is a thing that affects everybody, and it's really nice to see everybody get involved to fight it, because this doesn't help anybody. Evicting a person like Jennifer and her family doesn't help anybody. So I'm just going to turn the mic over to Jennifer. She's going to say a few words. Thank you very much.
First of all, let me say thank you for coming out.
When the judge signs the writ of eviction, they're going to assign a dumpster to be set in front of my home. And from that point, I have 24 hours to vacate the premises with all of my belongings, or the bailiffs will come out, go into my home, and take everything I have and throw it into that dumpster.
Oh my goodness.
The plan is that with the support that I have from my community and from Occupy Detroit, that they will block that from happening. They will block that dumpster from being set down. When that all happens, and if they can keep it from being set down, then that will give us more time to try and work things out with the bank.
A lot of the home eviction situations, if we're dealing with people who have had a hardship in their life. With Jennifer, her house was in her husband's name, and her husband passed, and she was not listed on the house. And she's sitting here making payments every month, so the payments are coming in for the house. But she's not listed as the owner on the house. So you have to wonder, is the bank, taking the amount down? Are they just collecting payments and then saying, well, this doesn't match with the house, but thank you for all these payments? If she takes it to court, she's acting in good faith. And the question is, can the bank act in good faith in return?
I'm here in the home with me and my husband's two children, my mother, and my uncle, who is mentally ill since birth. And, you know, we're living here comfortably. They're going to have to drag me out because I'm not going to go out freely. I'm not doing it.
What everybody hears is how violent Detroit is and how high the crime and so forth is. But I really, really like Detroit. And, you know, I don't have any plans of ever leaving Detroit, even with what I'm going through or whatever. I mean, I really like Detroit a lot.
And I think it has a great potential to come back. You know, it's suffering right now, but I think it has a great potential to come back.
Detroit's population started to decline around 1950, so this is not a new phenomenon. It's not something that happened overnight.
There's 4-7. Another 33 to go.
But as the city continued to, it basically bottomed out. We hit rock bottom, more or less. Skyscrapers started going dark. Hotels closed.
So after that 40-foot climb, in which I'm nearly dead, you're rewarded with one of the most amazing views of the city. And you can get a feel for just how majestic Detroit was and still is. Detroit, this tall tower off there in the distance, Detroit extends like another 5 miles past that. You know, I mean, it's like the city is just huge and it's too big. And it goes as far as you can see, basically. So the city, back in the 1950s, we had 2 million people, and we had a tax base of 2 million people supporting a city of this size. But one of our biggest problems now is that Detroit doesn't have 2 million people. We have 770,000 people, but we're supporting the same size city. So while it takes the same number of cops to patrol the same number of square miles, we don't have the same number of people paying for those cops. I mean, to give you an idea, you can fit Boston, Manhattan, and San Francisco combined within the city limits of Detroit and still have room left over. I mean, Manhattan has five times as many people as Detroit alone. So, I mean, this is technically a city that is big enough geographically to support like 10 million people.
When people are cast out of their homes, they're not sure where they're going next. I mean, I've sat in this situation myself. I've been fortunate in that I have a network of people I talked about, or you stay with this friend and you find a place to stay for a while. And you can only count on support for as long as support works. Then you have to go to the next thing and the next thing. And you may wind up exhausting your options at some point in time. It just may be, I don't know where to go next.
I'm single, I'm by myself, I live down here, it's way safer than if I was by myself under an overpass somewhere.
When I first was homeless, I had a car, you know, and then eventually shit happens where you don't have a car anymore, and it's a gradual process, but I think, yeah, when I didn't have a place to take a shower every day, that's when I was like, damn, this sucks.
I'm from Detroit. I used to live in Detroit when I was a child. My family is originally from Detroit. And actually, my great-grandma was born in Detroit, like, late 1880s, late 1890s, before the automobile. So, yeah, my family definitely goes back to Detroit. But, I don't know, it just kind of fell apart, you know. Detroit, I still love Detroit. You know, it's just sad.
We're in the Lee Plaza Hotel. The Lee Plaza was built in the late 1920s, closed in 1997. For the last 40 years of its life or so, it was a senior housing facility. But this gives you a taste of the grandeur of Detroit in the 1920s. And like so much of Detroit, it's just been left to rot, exposed to the elements, water, licking away the plaster. It's one of those places in Detroit that you see paradise lost. Has to figure out how to blaze a new path. Are we going to continue living in the past? Are we going to change the way that we do things? Are we going to, you know, just continue to make the same mistakes that we have made over and over and over again?
What happens in Detroit when houses get abandoned is that people come through. You have kids that are vandalizing, breaking windows for fun and things like that. But then you also have scrappers who are coming through and ripping out the wiring and the pipes to recycle the metal and get money for that. So when you enter an abandoned house, and I can even show you some of these that have not been cleaned out yet, they're in shambles, and also many times there's a lot of artifacts from the family who lived there, books and clothes and pots and pans, and it's a very eerie thing. It's like people just are gone. First thing we did was patch up the windows of this house because the windows were completely busted out. We did dumpster diving at the recycle centers and got all these wine bottles. Mainly what we have here are people who are exiting industrial society. A lot of the people here are artists, and they want to have time to develop their art, and they want to live with their own rhythms and not have to wake up an alarm clock and worry about bills and things like that. So this lifestyle, you can do that, and it is a lot like a rural lifestyle. It's a lot like being out in the country out here, and it's in the city.
This used to be the site of Peck Elementary School.
So in front of me back here was the school, and we're standing on what was the playground, right on the baseball diamond right here. So we've turned it into a really big vegetable garden right now. We're growing garlic and garlic scapes, sugar snap peas, carrots. Behind me in the hoop house here, we've got lots and lots of tomatoes for the summer, some peppers and eggplants, and we're branching into growing all kinds of things besides just vegetables too. For me, it just kind of puts together a lot of things, solving so many of the problems that we have. There's the problem of all this vacant space in the city that's unused. There's the jobs problem, where half the people in the city can't find sufficient work. There's the problem of our food system, where people shop at party stores and buy packaged unhealthy food. Detroit doesn't have any major supermarkets. There are smaller supermarkets. A problem for so many Detroiters, though, is they don't have transportation even to those. When we were planting our orchard out here, a neighbor went by, an older woman, who was walking miles up to Highland Park with a cart in order to go to a grocery store, because there's nothing in this neighborhood. And if you go to a corner store, a party store, they have chips and soda and pretzels and hot buns. Not the kind of thing you can cook with or feed a family with or stay healthy with.
Yeah, this is the newest part of our addition to the garden, and we just started this maybe 6 months ago. Most of the produce we grow out of here is our cash crops, like our basil and onion, paste, parsley. As you can see, we carefully take care of our babies. We come out here in the morning, we pray over it, and we water it just about every day. So it's really good, man. I mean, it's just a wonder to see things come from a little bitty seedling to something that you can actually eat. So. Yeah, so, I mean, like, it's just a group of individuals, man, who really believe in our city, who believe in the thriving newness. And so we just took an effort to reclaim something that nobody wanted to do or just was going to burn up or tear up. And so this is our landscape. It's like our own little Home Depot.
This is the crest of the sort of industrial modern consumer society, and it was the crest of the decline of that in the 70s. That's when my family left Detroit. So, and I also see this as the crest of what's coming forward. You know, this is the birthplace of techno music, and what is the post-industrial society going to be? I feel Detroit is going to be an important part of that conversation, and that's why I'm here. And I feel that also the people here in this community are saying, okay, how are we going to do this?
People say Detroit's like the Wild West because people just do what they want and what they have to in this city. We're really going outside of city planning and city governance out here. There's no allowance right now for urban agriculture, and the city's been spending years and years and years trying to do it. So everyone who's farming in this city has just decided to do it on their own without waiting for somebody to okay it. And I'm somebody who is better at just getting things done than trying to get other people to do things.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern, only here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us again on this episode and sharing with us your precious time, lending us a listening ear. And sometimes we don't necessarily have to learn new things from these discussions, but rather just take them as reminders and momentum so that we'd have a ray of light, at least today. There is a lot of emphasis in Islam regarding trying, regarding effort, regarding the will to improve ourselves and our skills and to use it in the direction of making the world a better place for ourselves and others and thus creating a better afterlife. Let's listen to a short story about effort and trying to get better, and we'll be right back.
This is Lantern, so welcome to this program. We have an interesting story entitled Writing a Composition. Children, tomorrow I shall expect all of you to write compositions, said the teacher of Love Lane School. Then on Friday, those who have done the best may stand up and read their composition to the school. Some of the children were pleased and some were not. What shall we write about? They asked. You may choose any subject that you like best, said the teacher. Some of them thought that home was a good subject. Others liked school. The next day, every pupil except one had written a composition. Henry Longfellow, said the teacher, why have you not written? Because I don't know how, answered Henry. He was only a child. Well, said the teacher, you can write words, can you not? Yes, sir, said the boy. After you have written three or four words, you can put them together, can you not? Yes, sir, I think so. Well, then, said the teacher, you may take your slate and go out behind the schoolhouse for half an hour. Think of something to write about and write the word on your slate. Then try to tell what it is like, what it is good for, and what is done with it. That is the way to write a composition. Henry took his slate and went out. Just behind the schoolhouse was Mr. Finney's barn. Quite close to the barn was a garden, and in the garden Henry saw a turnip. Well, I know what that is, he said to himself, and he wrote the word turnip on his slate. Then he tried to tell what it was like, what it was good for, and what was done with it. Before the half hour was ended, he had written a very neat composition on his slate. He then went into the house and waited while the teacher read it. The teacher was surprised and pleased. He said, Henry Longfellow, you have done very well. Today you may stand up before the school and read what you have written about the turnip. Many years after that, some funny little verses about Mr. Finney's turnip were printed in a newspaper. Some people said that they were what Henry Longfellow wrote on his slate that day at the school. Henry W. Longfellow was one of the most famous American poets.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
There's a beautiful narration from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam where His Eminence says, it's actually a supplication, a prayer. And His Eminence says to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, وَمْنُنْ عَلَيْنَا بِالنَّشَاطِ وَعِذْنَا مِنَ الْفَشَلِ وَالْكَسَلِ وَالْعَجْزِ وَالْعِلَلِ وَالضَّرَرِ وَالضَّجَرِ وَالْمَلَلِ. The word nishat in Arabic, and I think in Farsi too, means vigor, means liveliness, means spirit, means action, means spunk. To have that, you know, that constant movement in you, to be active, not to be stagnant, not to be a potato couch, not to be a couch potato, to have motivation. To pursue something that inspires me, that gives me joy, that tickles my soul, that uplifts my spirit. Now, the fact that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam makes it a point to pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give him nashat, to give him that sense of liveliness and virility, means that we probably should be asking Allah for that too. And it is so important to have that spirit and spunk in our lives. Often we hear stories about people who suffer from cancer, who suffer from a really aggressive illness, and the only thing that got them through was their spirit, the support of their loved ones that boosted their morale and their spirit, their belief and faith in perhaps a greater power, or that life is more than this and that they need a second chance to live life to the fullest. All of that, it boosted their morale and their spirit and helped them regain their energy and their health and heal a broken body. That's how strong willpower and the strength of our spirit can be. It can save us from any situation, any situation. Why does a person commit suicide? As sad as it is and as heartbreaking as it is that a person would want to take their own life, would want to deprive themselves of the greatest gift ever, is because they have a mind, a spirit that no longer wants to continue, that wants to end everything in an otherwise perfectly healthy body. Do you understand what I'm trying to say here? I'm trying to say that you could have all the wealth and all the awesome cars and the money and the parties and the friends and the followers and the likers and the admirers in the world, but if your heart is sad, if your spirit is low, if you're low on morale, if you're low on motivation, inspiration, reason, spark, spunk, something that would set your soul on fire, if you don't have that, then you will not have a reason to carry on. Now, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam proceeds in this supplication by asking Allah to save us from things such as inability, excuses, laziness. Though some psychologists believe that there's no such thing as laziness, and a person who is sluggish all the time just lacks the proper motivation to better themselves and push themselves and step out of their comfort zone. But by praying that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saves me from laziness, it's basically indicating that I'm asking for a motivation, for something to tickle my soul and get me moving, and for an inner drive to inspire me to do something better with myself. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.